All righty, we are studying the book of Samuel. I'm on page 192. We're on 2 Samuel 24, verse 18. So Gad came to David that day and said, "Go up and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite." And David went up according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord had commanded. The threshing floor of Arunah, whose name was also Ornan, was on Mount Moriah, which is now called Temple Mount. It is the site believed by Arabs, Jews, Muslims, about everybody in that part of the world who's has any history, where Abraham sacrificed Isaac to God, and God intervened to keep him from killing him. And so it's a holy place to those people over there whose religions are attached to Abraham. It is now the location of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the adjacent Dome of the Rock. Now, we talked about this a couple weeks ago about mountains in Israel. We went through a whole list of them. But right here at this little place, you've got three little mounts, because none of these are like Sinai or, you know, K2 or, you know, Himalayas or anything. These are mounts, but they're significant. You have the Mount of Olives, and then over there, slightly lower than that, you have Mount Moriah. And then to the right of that, you have a smaller mountain called Zion, Mount Zion. Zion was the place where David built, he captured it from the Jebusites, and he built his palace and all that there. And Carmel, of course, is where the Garden of Gethsemane is and all that sort of thing, with the Kidron Valley being between Carmel and Moriah. Moriah, the one in between, is where the temple is built. And the walls of Jerusalem go, the inner walls of Jerusalem go around Mount Moriah. The outer walls of Jerusalem go around and include Zion. Those walls have been built at various different times for purposes of protection. Y'all remember some dialogue about the Milo, which was built by David after he took it over in order to provide more barrier. Well, that includes that outer wall. That's what that's about. This particular flat spot, top of this mountain, which is technically called a Pisgah, this particular flat area at the top of this mountain was owned by a guy named Arunah, who was a Jebusite. Remember that all of this area belonged to Jebus. It was called Jebus. It was David captured it and renamed it Jerusalem. Remember that when the people came into the land, they were supposed to drive out all of the Canaanites before them, and some of the tribes were more successful at that than others. Some of them failed to be obedient to do that, and it wound up seducing them over the years and all this sort of thing. But one of the things that happened was is that the Jebusites were able to protect themselves from the oncoming Jews. And the city of Jebus was particularly well constructed for that. It was at the top of a mountain range, actually several. And, you know, I mean, when you go to the edge of the city of Jerusalem, it's a huge fall off. And that's where they threw their garbage over on the Kidron side. Remember the garbage pit that burned all day and all night, and Jesus said that, you know what I'm talking about? So the Jews would take all their garbage over to the side of the edge of the mountain on which Jerusalem is built, and they would dump it off on the Kidron side. And so what happened is over the centuries, a garbage dump grew at the foot of this mountain. And because of the methane and everything in that, it was smoked day and night. And it was foul and stench. It was hot, you know, because if you got around it. It was a very unwelcoming place. And so when Jesus compares eternal separation from God to Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, that gives people this image of hell as being this place of ongoing fire, ongoing smell, ongoing badness. Also, because it was a place of darkness in that sense, it was a good place for robbers to hang out, people sacrificing their children to Moloch. All the worst kind of people would hang out there, and the worst kind of deeds would hang out. That made it also dark in the moral sense. So the Valley of Kidron on the Hinnom side was thought of as a really awful, dark place. And so the nature of hell, or our visions of what hell is, grew up out of this sense of how ugly and bad and just nasty you certainly wouldn't want to build a nice house there in the Valley of Hinnom, and so who would want to live there? So therefore, the grossity of hell, or the difficulty, the badness of hell, was likened to all that by Jesus. Now, what happened is that some people then took it to be more than just metaphorical, and so they turned hell into this place with this ongoing fire. And that was complicated by the fact that words like fire and all that kind of stuff are used metaphorically to talk about cleansing and purging and that sort of thing. And so by the time we get to Dante and the people of the age of Dante, hell has become this roaring fire that you burn all the time, but you're never consumed. Which God would have to work a miracle for that to happen. And he's by definition separated from those people. You'd have to have a body that wouldn't consume, and therefore it wouldn't be able to feel burning. Or so if it has to feel burning, then it's going to be consumed. You know, you can't sort of have it both ways. God would have to work a contrary miracle, you know, around a square circle, in order to make that happen like that. But, you know, the uneducated people of the ancient world ran very quickly to these kind of images. The Romans perpetuated these images. The Greeks perpetuated these images. All of these cultures had a punishment other world. It was always dark, and there was fire, and there was smoke, and it stunk, and, you know, scary. They're all that way. The river Styx, all this kind of stuff. They're all that way. And so this is where a lot of this imagery, the non-biblical imagery of hell comes from, is this thing. The Mount Moriah, when David conquered this area, it's a sizable area. And even though he took it over and he built his palace and his city and all of that on Zion, he didn't drive out all of the people. So even in David's day, the Pisgah, or the flat space on top of Mount Carmel, was owned by a Jebusite. This Jebusite may have actually become a proselyte Jew for convenience sake, for political reasons. Nobody's saying whether he did or didn't, but he was a functioning member of society. Remember that Uriah, who was killed for David, for his wife, was a Hittite. Benaiah, or Ittai, who was one of David's generals, was a Gittite. He was a Philistine. So there was a lot of various people from various cultures that had taken high positions. For instance, Henry Kissinger couldn't be president because he was not American. But he had a very high position in our government. You know what I'm saying? There was, down through history, you got that way. There were people who were surrounding George Washington and all those kind of people that couldn't take high office because they weren't Americans. They were French, very often, or they were Hessians. They were, you know, or Polish. Tadeusko was that guy who came over and trained a lot of our army. So we wouldn't have a trained army if it hadn't been for a Polish guy who came over. That is Kosciuszko or something like that. So, at any rate, fifth grade history. I'll get it for you. Huh? Von Steuben was the German. He was the Hessian. But there was a Polish guy also. Like Lafitte was a French guy, you know. So, at any rate, the threshing floor of Araunah was owned by a Jebusite. And God told David to go and make an offering there. Without David realizing this was going to be the future home of the temple, the Dome of the Rock, you know, all of that sort of thing. Araunah looked down and he saw the king and his servants crossing over toward him. And Araunah went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. And Araunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" And David said, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back, from my people." Araunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight." Just help yourself. Look, there are oxen for burnt offering, there are threshing sledges and yokes of oxen for wood. Everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king. Araunah said to the king, "May the Lord accept you. May he accept your offering." However, the king said, "Araunah, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." Now this is, we have the same argument going on when Abraham's trying to buy a burial cave for his wife. And remember, the local people at Shechem are trying to give or donate the lot to him, and he refuses to be in their debt. And so he refuses to take even a discounted price. And so once they've got him in that position, which they knew very well what they were doing, then they name an exorbitant price for the land at Machpelah, and Abraham pays it. So this is just typical trading procedures in this day. So Araunah starts off, this very typical process, let me give it to you. Now, if David says, okay, I'll take it, then David is in Araunah's debt. And so Araunah gains more out of that than what he loses by a couple of oxen and, you know, wood sled and, you know, a sacrifice, whatever. He gains leverage over David, first of all, David didn't want to give him. And secondly, David says, I will not make an offering to the Lord that doesn't cost me anything. I will not take somebody else's money and offer it to the Lord. That's a worthless offering. Our offerings to the Lord should be a sacrifice. They should feel like a sacrifice. They should feel like we're giving something of ours to Him, that we're actually paying a price. So if I steal money from somebody else and go make large donations to the church or whatever, and I get all glorified for all of this, the fact that I've stolen the money from somewhere else, you know, God knows. We have a tendency very often to want to kind of toss God leftovers. He doesn't like that. In Malachi, for instance, he told the people, I wish someone would lock the doors of the church because your offerings to me are like vomit on my altar. Because you offer with bad attitude, you offer damaged and diseased goods, you offer that which is not your own. None of that is acceptable. Well, David knew better. He said, no, I will buy it for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor of the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And there David built an altar to the Lord, and he offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus David was moved by, the Lord was moved by the entreaty for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. I think we've covered most of this. Pardon? No, a threshing floor, it goes like this, okay? You have, you gather up all your grain, and what you need is a pretty good size flat spot where you can set up like a post and put a wheel-like thing on it, and then you can attach donkeys and or oxen on it, and they will walk around the post, okay? And what happens is they walk all over this grain. And then after they've walked on it for a while, you take a pitchfork and you throw it up in the air, and the chaff blows away. And so little by little, the grain builds up on the floor. Now, if you have a big harvest, you might have 7, 8, 10 of these threshing posts going on around this place. So you need a big, flat place. And by the time the oxen walk on it for 4 or 5 decades, it becomes just really pounded down and whatever. And, you know, flat as a flitter and the whole nine yards. So it's a valuable piece because it's where, like Jebusite, Araunah may have had a business where many people around him brought their grain to him to be threshed. It's like a mill, sawmill or something like that. Because, you know, he had this big flat spot. They would not. If we see the story of Ruth, we see them out harvesting during the season, the barley season. They're harvesting at 7th month and they're It's taking months to get the harvesting done, weeks anyway, and they're sleeping in the fields overnight to travel back and forth from their various homes would make a lot of sense. So they wind up camping out for a month or 6 weeks to do all of this, and they have to do that at some place that will accommodate all these people. You see what I'm saying? So one of the images that Isaiah has, which is particularly poetically telling, is he said, I look down upon you and I see my house like a cucumber shed in a blank field. Well, what he means is if you have a cucumber plot and you're going to be harvesting all of those, and it might be, you know, many, many, many acres, because a lot of people would grow together, see. But you would have a shed somewhere, you see, around the middle, and in that shed you would keep tools. And it might have, my grandfather had these, it might have a roof over top on posts to provide shade. And, you know, like, so what they would do is they would put their tractor there overnight to give it some cover. During the day, they would come there and eat their lunch because it was the only, it's a big wide open field with nothing but sun. And so the shed, which kept all the tools and other supplies, and then this big awning-like thing they had over it, it provided the only place you could sit down and eat your lunch in some shade. It was kind of a dog track affair, if you've ever been to Texas and seen a dog track house. It was, you all know what a dog track house is? You guys have to be... Dog trot, dog track, whichever you want to call it. Basically, this is cool because you see these around Texas. Yeah, you got a piece of land, and you've got a house, and this people live here in this room. People live in this room, and this is open. And it's open in order to provide air going through there. And the dogs, when they're chasing each other, they're running around, running through this open spot. So it's called a dog trot house or a dog track house, whatever. Well, that's the way these sheds were. You'd have a shed, and then you'd have an awning, you know, on a post out here. And this is all shade now. And so people are there, you know, drinking their mason jar full of cool water that they've managed to keep cool by whatever mechanism, you know, uses the shade, or, you know, they're eating their sack lunch or whatever they're doing. They would go there at night and sleep. So if he had a little rainstorm or something came up, they'd have a little bit of shelter there. So when you have the image of Ruth and her, all those people harvesting at the barley harvest, and at night they're all kind of laying around sleeping on sacks of stuff, and she goes and lifts the skirt of Boaz and sleeps at his feet, offer of marriage. Remember all this stuff? It's going on in an environment like this, where you've got a big threshing floor or a big threshing area set up for this. And in the case of the imagery out of Isaiah, he said, I look down and all I see is a flat land with a cucumber shed sticking up. And in other words, Israel is empty and their temple rises up like an old cucumber shed, because it's just empty. It's damaged. It's famine. I mean, it's not fruitful, whatever that is. David has gone to this particular place, which is popular, well known. It's a common place of business. It would be a very public offering. People, it would have enough room for people to be around, miles around. And he's going to make this offering to the Lord to try to get this plague will stop. Acknowledging sin, all that sort of thing. This guy offers to let him have a couple of these oxen he's got around here and a couple of a sled or something, and he can do all this kind of stuff. He said, you know, help yourself. And David said, no, I'm going to buy it from you. I'm going to pay you full price. I'm not going to leverage it like the king, because then I'll owe you. I'm not going to take it on discount, because then I'll owe you. God forbid, but I should give to God what does not belong to me. So Araunah charges him 50 shekels of silver for the land and the oxen used in threshing. David built the altar and sacrificed the oxen to the Lord. God had mercy and ended the plague. Yes, son?
Could the guy have refused to sell it? I'm just thinking of the time with...
Well, he had legal rights to do that. Mm-hmm. He had legal rights to do that. I mean, there are people who stood up to the king on various issues. Well, in the case of Ahab and Jezebel, the owner, what was his name? The owner of the vineyard refused to sell it to him. And, Ahab went home and... No, Nabob is the, it was the fool who was married to the Carmelite.
Yeah.
Abigail. I forgot his name just now, but at any rate, the point is that he refused, and Ahab, who understood the law, went home and wrung his hands and said, he won't sell me the property. And Jezebel said, well, let me show you how it's done at our place, you know. We're really pagans. And so she plotted and had him killed and then stole the property. That kind of behavior is what got them all destroyed. So, but yes, I mean, he could have said no. he might have felt politically pressured or something, but 50 shekels of silver is going to be a big piece of money. So there was none of that going on here. Alrighty. You know, it was sometime, some years after this, that they actually built the temple on this spot. Remember when David was told he couldn't build the temple, but he was allowed to provide for it. You know, he went out and got metals, and he went out and got wood, and he went out and got craftsmen and designers and stuff for making curtains. And remember, he gathered all that together so that his son Solomon could build the temple. Well, here he's provided the site. He's paid for the site. All right. Going on to page 194, 1 Kings 1. The end of the story of King David is told in the first two chapters of the biblical book of Kings, and so it is included in any study of 2 Samuel. It should be. 1 Kings 1:1. Now King David was old and advanced in age, and they covered him with clothes, and he could not keep warm. So his servants said to him, "Let them seek a young virgin for my lord the king. Let her attend the king, become his nurse, and let her lie in your bosom, that my lord the king may keep warm." So they searched for a beautiful girl throughout all the territory of Israel. They found Abishag the Shunammite. They brought her to the king, and the girl was very beautiful. She became the king's nurse and served him, but the king did not cohabit with her. In other words, they were not able to have sex, is what he was saying. Now, whoever invented the electric blankets really messed us up, you know. I think they had a much better idea, you know. So some woman, I'm sure, invented the electric blanket. What these people do about medicine was less than we do. In some cases, they had home remedies and understandings are better than what we use or whatever. And they couldn't keep his temperature up. And so they said, "Well, we'll find this young virgin, and she'll, when he's asleep, she'll sleep in there with him naked, and that'll keep his temperature up. And if his temperature starts to go in the afternoon, we'll just say, 'Abishag, jump in there and help the old boy,' you know." So, at any rate, this looks to us pretty scurrilous, but to them it would not have been, there would have been no shame attached to this or whatever. Now, what it would mean, though, is that she was now wife. She couldn't move on to somebody else. There would have been an assumption that there was coitus, but we're told here that there was not. But nonetheless, this was his last wife, is what it was. And that kept him going for a while. He's old and feeble. Cannot keep his body temperature, which is this. Neither clothing nor covering or blanket was keeping warm. So David lay with her for warmth. He never consummated the relationship sexually. The girl's name was Abishag, and she was from Shunem, a city in Issachar, about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. So exotic as it may sound, it did not help David for long, and she became an enormous political pawn. The story of Abishag is what's going on next here, and then it leads right into Song of Solomon. But so, 1 Kings 5. Now, yes.
In nursing homes and stuff, they keep the temperatures really high.
Yeah.
Because people are cold.
Yeah, we're going through this right now with Nancy's mother. When you walk into her house, you know, it's like a sauna, you know. And fortunately, I don't have hot flashes, so it's the people who do, it's really bad. But you go into a nursing home and, I remember when I was a kid, one of the things that would happen to us, when we would go to the country to visit the grandparents, particularly my father's side, there was always a really elongated Catholic service in the morning, and we all loved it. It was fine. Then we would come home and we'd eat a really big chicken dinner. You know, they'd fry about 12 chickens and whatever, you know, whatever. And we'd eat chicken and gravy and all that kind of stuff. And then people would gather around, and people would do the dishes, and the men would all gather in the living room, whatever. After a while, the women would all gather in the living room, and they would all sit in their various chairs, and Grandma and Grandpa both had their rockers and their various chairs, and other people found a place to sit. And we children were required to be there and sit there and be still. It was torture. If they were in a particularly good mood, we could go out on the porch and swing on the swing, the three-seater swing on the porch, but not high and not loudly, okay? That's just, we couldn't go off the porch, and we were still in our Sunday clothes, because this is the worship of the Sabbath. Okay, so what happened is about 1 o'clock, everybody get done with dinner, and about 2:30, the whole room was snoring. They would jack this fireplace up, you know, in the winter especially. They would jack this fireplace up, and so it would be like, it'd be like a toaster oven in there. And the old folks are just zoning away, and, you know, their mouths are open and their teeth, their dentures are flopping loose, and, you know, or they'd get the snort and the dentures would clickety clack. I mean, it was, these are the memories I have of when they tore that old house down. One of the things that we found is that there was an upstairs room where all the men slept, or the boys, anybody. Grandma and Grandpa had their bedroom, and there was another bedroom down there that used to belong to my Aunt Doris, and somebody would have that. But all the men would be upstairs in an attic that was floored over and whatever. There was actually a back stairs that went down into the closet of my grandparents' bedroom, but then there was this front steps that went out into the living room. But from there, you could see the walls. You could look down the walls. And when they tore that old house down, we used to go out there all the time, even if they tore it down, because it came down in pieces. It kind of, you know, rotted over the years. The walls in between the outer area and the living walls are all filled with old newspapers. Whenever they got done with the newspaper, they would fold it up, take it up, and drop it down inside of these openings where the, you know, where the studs are, the opening between the studs. And remember, what you don't have in those openings is electrical wiring. So, you know, what you did have was lathing with, you know, some plaster in it. But so they would pack these newspapers. And over 50 years, those walls were absolutely, totally insulated with newspaper between the lathing on the one side and the exterior on the other. So that living room and the front bedroom where Grandma and them were, those things got toasty. And so, yeah, the old folks, they crank it up. So, you know, the rest of us were running around outside, you know, whatever, probably our own body temperature, but they would crank it up. Alrighty. All right, verse 5. Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself. Adonijah is one of David's sons, whose mother was Haggith, one of David's wives. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted him, saying, I will be king. So he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen, 50 men, to run before him. And his father had never crossed him at any time by asking, why have you done so? Remember, we've already had Absalom, who used to go out with 50 horsemen, praying around, being the young, bon vivant prince. And he's now dead. And we had Amnon, who Absalom killed because he raped his sister. He's dead. Several other of David's sons have died. And so here's Adonijah. I think he's fourth and he's next. So his father never challenged him about why he was strutting himself all around the city with his 50 men running before his chariots. David was not good at confronting his sons on issues like this. He was also a very handsome man. He was born after Absalom, and he had conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, with Abiathar the priest, and following Adonijah, they helped him. So David's old, and everybody's looking to the future to see where it lays, where the power lays, where what's going to happen. Adonijah's next in line. He's a young, handsome, studly man. He's had the temple education, and he looks like the heir apparent. And so Zeruiah and Abiathar the priest, and Abiathar the priest, they align themselves with Adonijah because he looks like he's the next one along. So they helped him. They began to lend their weight behind his subtle campaign to be next king. And everybody gets to look at that, and so it begins to be, he's going to be the next, you know. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Ray, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. Adonijah was apparently not much of a warrior. And some of these men had no respect for that. They didn't follow him for various reasons. So he's the fourth-born son. Absalom, Kileab, whose also name is Daniel, and Amnon all died. Adonijah supposed he would be king. Zadok the priest, Benaiah, and the others mentioned were supporters of Solomon, partly because they were prophetic men who knew what God had promised. Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen, fatlings by the stone of Zoheleth, which is beside Enrogel, and he invited all of his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. Now, we've seen feasts like this once before, haven't we? Remember when Absalom put on a feast like this, and then he wound up killing Amnon at this feast? Remember this? Everybody thought the king's sons were dead, but it was only Amnon who was killed. Well, this is a typical... Adonijah's beginning to entertain as a royal, and people are starting to line themselves up. The old king is crickety at best, you know. All of his energies are spent getting warm. Work, 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 work. All right. Then Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, Nathan the prophet. Have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king? And David, our Lord, does not know it. So he says, for all practical purposes, he's become king. So now come, please, let me give you counsel and save your life and the life of your son Solomon. The reason he's saying this is because, typically speaking, whoever becomes king then moves immediately to eliminate his competitors, as in kill them. And so because of Bathsheba's obvious popularity with David, his preferred wife, like Rachel was preferred by Jacob, and therefore Joseph was preferred by Jacob, it was evident to people around David who saw this that Bathsheba was the favorite wife and Solomon was the favorite son. But he was younger. He was quite a bit younger. And he had no political power, nor any... He didn't have a lot of political moxie, apparently. He certainly wasn't a fighter. And so these men said, look, Adonijah's become king. He's taken over. The only thing left is to bury David, and he's there. So he said, let me give you counsel that will save your life and the life of your son Solomon. Because when David's dead, Solomon's dead, and you too. So go at once to David and say to him, have you not, my lord, O king, sworn to your maidservant, saying, surely Solomon, your son, shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Which David did, in fact, swear to her. Why then has Adonijah become king? Well, then they said, behold, while you're still there speaking with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words. So Bathsheba went into the king in the bedroom. The king was very old. Abishag the Shunammite was ministering to the king. He's probably just passing out hors d'oeuvres at this point. And then Bathsheba bowed and prostrated herself before the king. And the king said, what do you wish? She said to him, my lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, surely your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne. And now behold, Adonijah is king, and now my lord the king, you do not know it. He has sacrificed oxen and fatlings and sheep in abundance, and invited all the sons of the king, and Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army. But he has not invited Solomon your servant. As for you now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel on you to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise, it will come about as soon as my lord the king sleeps with his fathers that I and my son will be considered offenders, will be dead. Do you remember us having a long conversation about the principle, the Old Testament principle, the old world principle, even the New Testament, of adoption? Mm-hmm. How the father would wait to adopt his heirs until late in life, once he knew what kind of people they were and whether that they would continue with his programs and that sort of thing. And that kept the young people subservient to the father because they wanted to be cared for in the adoption process. And so what happened is that was a process of controlling your offspring. Remember we talked about that? Talked about the fact that people very often adopted people, not even their own sons, over their sons, because their sons were not worthy to rule and reign. Example, of course, would be Julius Caesar, whose own son, Caesarion, was considered unworthy to reign. And so he adopted, late in life, the adult nephew, Octavius, who became Augustus Caesar. That's the way it was done. So when Paul talks about how God has given us, has adopted us, what he's saying is God has shown you great favor. He's adopted you. He selected you. We have a tendency to use the word adoption in a very different sense than they do. In our world, and especially before recently, adoption's become more popular again now. But it used to be that adoption was something that sort of happened because somebody died and left kids homeless, you know, whatever. So we have all often thought of adopted children as second rate. You know, I mean, you would even have battles in the family where we were real children, you were just adopted. And there was this whole sense of adoption, adopted kids being second rate. But in the biblical era, adopted was higher than just born of flesh, because it was the adopted ones who inherit. So you see that in Romans, where he talks about the spirit of adoption. You see that, for instance, in Ephesians, where he talks about our spiritual inheritance. We've been adopted. Now, that means personally selected and chosen, not just born of the flesh. So Paul's trying to tell us we need to seriously step up to the great grace that's befallen us by being adopted. And when we read that with our 21st century eyes without any understanding, we go, well, we've been adopted. Well, you know, second class citizens. We're not Jews. You know, the Jews are the real people. We're not. We've just been adopted. Well, it was up to David to adopt somebody at this point and proclaim them king. In other words, part of what his inheritance was to pass out to his children were lands and houses and all this sort of thing, and who would be king. And David's been... you put these things off as long as you can, and he's put it off as long as he can. At any rate, Nathan says, I will come in and support what you have to say. And so it's a little conspiracy here. No prior commitment to Solomon by name is recorded, other than the promise David made to Bathsheba. But it's likely it was true because David loved Bathsheba a great deal and confirms his commitment in verse 30 below, and he moves immediately to secure Solomon's throne. So it was very likely that even though there's no written record other than the one I mentioned before, that that was truth. All right, 1 Kings 1:22. Behold, while she was still speaking with the king, Nathan the prophet came in, and he told the king, saying, here is Nathan the prophet. Guess what? Nathan just happened to drop by. And when he came in before the king, he prostrated himself before the king, his face to the ground, and Nathan said, my lord the king, have you said that Adonijah shall become king after me, and he shall sit on my throne? For he has gone down today, has sacrificed oxen, fatlings, and sheep in abundance, has invited all the king's sons, commanders of the army, Abiathar the priest. Behold, they are eating and drinking before him, and they are saying, long live King Adonijah. But me, even your servant, and Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, your servant Solomon, remember Benaiah is David's personal bodyguard, and your son Solomon, he has not been invited. Has this thing been done by my lord the king, and you not shown to your servants who sit on your on the throne of my lord the king after him? Have you adopted Adonijah in this place and didn't tell anybody? King answered and said, call Bathsheba to me. So they bring her back in. Came to the king's presence, stood before the king. The king vowed and said, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, surely I vowed to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place. I will indeed do this to this day. Now, if you can kind of get a sense of the magisterium of the court here, maybe one of the best scenes that you have is from the Ten Commandments, whenever Pharaoh is holding court and people are coming in. And when he gets done making a proclamation like this, somebody says, so let it be written, so let it be done. Okay, that's the official, you know, etch this in stone, this is what it is. Well, that's what's going on here. David has brought these people back in, his scribe's been brought in, and he has made it official in writing this. Then Bathsheba bowed down with her face to the ground and prostrated herself before the king and said, may my lord King David live forever. And I hope you and Abishag have a nice time. 1 Kings 1:32. Then David said, call to me Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. So they came into the king's presence. The king said to them, take with you the servants of your lord. Have my son Solomon ride on my own mule, and bring him down to Gihon, and let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him there as king over Israel, and blow the trumpet and say, long live King Solomon. Then you shall come up after him, and he shall come and sit on my throne and be king in my place, for I have anointed him to be ruler over Israel and Judah. And Benaiah the son of Jehoiada answered, said to the king, Amen. Thus may the Lord, the God of my lord the king, say, As the Lord has been with my lord the king, so may he be with Solomon, and make his throne greater than the throne of my lord the king David. So Zadok the prince, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, these are David's personal army, went down and had Solomon ride on King David's mule. Remember, kings in peace come on mules, kings in war come on horses. Ride on King David's mule, brought him to Gihon. Zadok the priest then took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. They blew the trumpet. All the people said, Long live Solomon. This is big. Townspeople are gathering around for, as far as you can see, huge crowd. Big deal. Horns being blown. Here comes Solomon on the chariot. You know, here's the army. Here's the Pelethites. You know, they pour the anointing on him. People are gathered around. It's a big deal. I don't know off right offhand, but I would guess he's 18 or 19 or something like that. I probably could figure it out, but I don't remember that. What?
So he wasn't like a little child.
No, he's not like he's not a tyke.
He's like a young man.
No, he's not a tyke. But he's fifth or sixth, seventh born.
Okay.
So he's probably maybe the early 20s even, but probably 18 or 19, something like that. There's probably data in the scripture that gets me there. I just can't remember.
Do we know how old David was now?
Well, yeah, he's probably 70 something. Well, when he gets ready to die here, they're going to say how many years he's,
okay,
how years he owes when he dies. But they'll say, but he's reigned for 40 years, and I think he becomes king at about age 30. So he should be in the 70s or something like that. But we'll know here in a little bit, because when they wrap him up, they'll say, you know, and he lived to be so many years, and he reigned so many years, whatever. I don't remember exactly his number. Long live Solomon, all the people went up after him. The people were playing on flutes and rejoicing with great joy, so that the earth shook at their noise. This is a big crowd and a big to-do. All right. To ensure that Solomon reigns, David makes him co-regent immediately. Co-regency was a practice that was new to Israel, but common to other nations, and it became a time-honored practice in Israel afterwards, even in the millennial reign, when the human Jewish prince will rule Israel from Jerusalem under King Jesus, who rules the world from the New Jerusalem, come down from out of heaven. Now, there's some chapters in Ezekiel you can read about that. But down through history, we've seen co-regents a number of times. One of them that's really famous that we've studied before is, remember that Nebuchadnezzar had a son named Nabonidus. And Nabonidus was a warrior like his father, but he had a son named Belshazzar. Belshazzar was a playboy. So while Nabonidus went to war, Belshazzar reigned in Babylon. You remember the whole writing on the wall and all that sort of thing. So Belshazzar and Nabonidus were co-regents at the same time. And this happened often down through history. And one of the reasons why it's sometimes hard to track numbers and get to right dates is because of co-regencies. Because if David reigned, 40 years, and Solomon reigned 40 years, you'd think that makes 80 years, but it doesn't. It only might make 73 years, because they're 7 years together. And so when you're doing your studies based upon the numbers, based upon all this, you have to take co-regencies. Sometimes when dates don't work out right, if you go back and look, you'll see co-regencies, and you'll see that. So it was not uncommon for even more kings, like in the age of Elizabethans and whatever, to have co-regencies sometimes. Typically, a couple years for little kids or something like that. But at any rate, and Adonijah and all the guests who were with him heard it. As they finished eating, when Joab heard the sound of the trumpet, he said, Why is the city making an uproar? The general wants to know why there's a roar in the camp. While he was speaking, behold, Jonathan's son Abiathar the priest came. Now, Abiathar the priest had been a firm supporter of King David. In fact, it was Abiathar who was the Zadok the priest had remained behind when Absalom took over. He was David's spy, and he sent his son Abiathar back and forth with the message. And Abiathar had been a supporter of David. But he's lying himself with the wrong horse here. Then Adonijah said, "Come in, Jonathan, son of Abiathar the priest, for you know you're a valiant man." And Adonijah said, "Come in, for you're a valiant man, bring good news." But Jonathan answered and said to Adonijah, "No, our Lord King David has made Solomon king. The king has also sent with him Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of the Jehoiada, the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and they made him ride on the king's mule. Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet have anointed him king in Gihon, and they have come up there for rejoicing. So the city is in an uproar, and this is the noise which you have heard. Besides, Solomon has even taken his seat on the throne of the kingdom. Moreover, the king's servants come to bless our Lord, King David. Say, may your God make your name, Solomon, better than the name than your name, and his throne greater than your throne." And the king bowed himself on the bed. The king also said thus, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted one to sit on my throne today, while my own eyes see it." And all the guests of Adonijah were terrified. And they arose, each went his own way. Adonijah was afraid of Solomon. He rose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Adonijah knows full well what he would have done to Solomon were he to become king. And so he figures his life isn't worth spit. So he runs to the horns of the altar in the tabernacle, and he holds onto the horns of the altar, believing that no one would kill him there. Now it was told Solomon, saying, "Behold, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon. For behold, he's taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword." Solomon said, "If he will be a worthy man, not one of his hairs will fall to the ground. But if wickedness is found in him, he will die." So King Solomon sent, and they brought him down before the altar. And he came and prostrated himself before King Solomon, from the altar. And he prostrated himself before King Solomon. Solomon said, "Go to your house." That means you are exiled to your home, to your estates. That's what that means. As time drew near, time to die drew near, David charged Solomon his son, saying, "I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, the Torah, that you may succeed in all you do, wherever you turn, so the Lord may carry out his promise which he has spoken concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful in their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." So David is trying to impart some wisdom to his son as he dies. Be a man of God if you want to see your throne established. Keep the Torah. Remember, we've talked about Psalm 19 many times and what definition of the Torah, precepts and statutes and commands, etc., etc. Keep the Torah according to what's written in the law of Moses. If you do that to the best of your ability, God will be faithful to you as he was with me. Now, David knows, and Solomon knows, everybody knows that David has had his sins. There are times when he broke the Torah, but they also know that he repented and God forgave him. And that in the main, David was a man who walked after God. So he's saying to Solomon, if you will make your walk after the Lord, you know, I mean, you'll slip up once in a while, but try not to, because if you'll keep this, your king will be established, you'll be a happy man, etc., etc. Now you know also, he said, what Joab the son of Zerah did to me, what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in time of peace. He put the blood of war on his belt around his waist and on his sandals and on his feet. So act according to your wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down in shale in peace. David is settling accounts. So he says, I'm getting ready to die, and here's some things you need to do. One is you need to deal with Joab. He's treacherous. He's cost me grief a number of times. He's used his position as a general to wage war, personal war, in times of peace. And he's brought great harm to the kingdom doing all this. Don't let him live, because he will be a thorn in your side. Remember, Joab now is much older than Solomon, even though he was younger than David, but he's older than Solomon. And he's obviously sided with Adonijah. So he tells Joab to execute Joab for three reasons. Joab killed Absalom in direct regard for David's orders. Remember this. He killed Abner and jeopardized the peace that David made with the house of Saul. Remember that? And he killed Amasa, whom David had appointed general over the war after Absalom was over. Those are all three men he killed for personal reasons. He waged personal war in times of peace and threatened David's reign several times. Several times David's reign almost didn't happen because of Joab. Do not let this treachery go on in your reign. David replies, it could be more than you can handle. But shows kindness to the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite. Remember him? He was the old man, 80-year-old man, who brought food and supplies to David when David was fleeing, and supplied him in the wilderness. And then when David won over Absalom, David asked Barzillai to come up to Jerusalem and live with him and eat at his table every day. And Barzillai said, I'm too old, I couldn't even enjoy the food you give me. But take my son and, treat him as you would treat me. Remember that story? Mm-hmm. So he's saying, make sure you're kind to Barzillai, the Gileadite, another non-Jewish person. And let them be among those, I mean, he's Jewish, but he wasn't born a Jew. Let them be among you, those who eat at your table, for they assisted me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. Behold, there is with you Shimei, the son of Gera, Gera the Benjamite, of Bahurim. Now, you remember Shimei? He was the guy when David was fleeing at the house of Nob the priest, and he was throwing stones and spitting on him and uttering curses. And remember, Joab wanted to go up and take his head off, and David said, no, let him curse me, because if I'm guilty, maybe God will have mercy on me, and if I'm innocent, then God will justify me, so let him go. And then afterwards, Shimei comes to David with hat in hand and said, I must have been having a bad moment, I'm so sorry, and whatever. And David forgave him, but not any longer. So he said, remember Shimei? It was he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day when I went to Mahanaim, the two camps. And when he came down to me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now therefore, do not let him go unpunished, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do to him. You will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. You don't need him around either. He's not going to help your kingdom out a whole lot. I promised him I wouldn't kill him. I didn't promise him you wouldn't. Then David slept with his fathers, was buried in the city of David. And he reigned over Israel for 40 years, 7 years in Hebron, 30 years, 33 in Jerusalem. Solomon sat on the throne of David, and his firm was firmly established. Somewhere in here we'll get an age on David, but it'd be up in the 70s, I would guess.
You know what this reminds me of is that movie, The Godfather.
Yeah. It's very much The Godfather. It's very much The Godfather, like when the Marlon Brando's dying, and he goes, remember the guys from Chicago? What's going on here is not unique to this. I mean, this has gone on throughout history whenever the change of regime happens in realms. If the young fellow coming in doesn't move to deal with his adversaries and his father's adversaries, he won't be king very long. So there's always this purging. Now, in some more civilized times, the purging is less deadly, but there's still always the purging. And a really good example of that is when the Democrat gets elected president, who all gets fired? All the Republicans, by and large, and vice versa. Now, every once in a while, usually, the president will find someone from the other party they can keep on so they can say they're bipartisan. But it's someone, some one person. And into the second term, that usually goes away too. But it's just the spoils of the victory, and it's nepotism at a very high level. I think I've finished there. Verse 13. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, said, she said, do you come peacefully? You got peace on your mind, or you got something else? He said, oh, peacefully, I've come peacefully. Then he said, I have something to say to you. And she said, speak. So he said, the kingdom was mine, and all Israel expected me to be king. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. Now I'm making one request of you, do not refuse one small thing. you know, don't refuse me this. You know, the kingdom was mine, but I see the Lord wanted Solomon, and so I've accepted all that. She said, what is it you want? He said, please speak to me, Solomon the king, for he will not refuse you, that he may give me Abishag the Shunammite as wife. Okay. This is David's last wife. She's a young, vibrant wife. She's famous because he marries one of David's wives. He can. It establishes his claim to the throne. We've already had this, remember, and all this stuff about Absalom bedding down the 10 concubines and over and over and over. Remember that Abner had propped up Mephibosheth as the king of northern kingdom. He was a young son of Saul. Abner had reigned as a military governor for 5 years, and then he props up Mephibosheth as the king. He's still reigning from the background, but that's what he does. And then Abner goes out and marries one of Saul's concubines, and Mephibosheth takes offense at it, remember? And he calls Abner to account, and he's because he said, you married one of Saul's concubines. Well, it doesn't sound like much, but what he's saying is you're trying to take the throne away from me. And Abner, he's sort of going, you know, that's not my interest. I like the gal, you know. He said, you're going to make war over me after all I've done with you over a woman? Remember he said? Well, this is that whole thing going on. So Mephibosheth understands clearly what the implications are of Abner marrying one of Saul's wives, or at least what they could be. Abner claims he's innocent, but finally Abner says, the heck with that. I'll deliver you, in a sack to King David, and we'll go from there. So here we go. So just a little request. He may give me Abishag the Shunammite as wife. Abishag the Shunammite, you know, Solomon is not likely to go marry as a 20-year-old guy or 22 or whatever he is, one of the 60-year-old wives of David or 70-year-old wives of David. But he might be interested in Abishag the Shunammite, who's his age.
Who was the wife
of David. That's right. So the point is we're going to see in Song of Solomon that actually Solomon has a great deal of fondness for her that has nothing to do with her political position. Of course, Adonijah wouldn't know that. And we don't know if that developed after this or was already in place. But Bathsheba cannot see the snake in this basket, but Solomon can.
Understand what this meant, what he was asking her to do?
Because she's not a modern woman like you with a law degree. She doesn't concern herself with politics and those kinds of things. I mean, it's a woman like Abigail, for instance, who had insight into the way things were. That's why she was so highly prized by David, because, you know, this is not what the average woman gave themselves to. They gave themselves to serving their husbands, taking care of their children, making sure the household was all warm and fuzzy and whatever. And, you know, daytime television. I mean, you know, they weren't the users that sophisticated. And Bathsheba is not known for her brains. Okay? I'm not saying she didn't have any, but she certainly didn't have any ear. She didn't see this coming. Bathsheba said, well, sure, I will speak to the king for you. So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah. And the king rose to meet her, bowed before her, sat on his throne. Then he had a throne set for the king's mother and sat on his throne. So he's honoring Bathsheba as the queen mother. Now, to your point, in these ancient kingdoms, the queen mother often had a lot of power. Much of it's ceremonial, but in some cases it got to be political. For instance, Athaliah, who was the daughter of Jezebel, who basically wound up killing her husband, the king, and wound up ruling, and then tried to rule through her sons. This is much later in Israel's time. Jezebel, who is one of those sophisticated women with a law degree, those kind of people. And they
that's a compliment. You're saying that, okay?
No, I'm just
across that.
I'm just saying they don't have the kind of sophistication that a modern Western woman would have. They very often don't have a political mind. I'm giving you examples of women who do, but they're not the norm, okay? And a lot of them have wisdom about how things are, but they're not going to be politically minded. Or the women who do tend to insinuate themselves from behind. They influence, whatever. Abigail's jumping out to try to save her husband's a little more aggressive than usual, but it stands out. If you read the Proverbs lady, we see a person who's got her brains all together, but she's not assaulting the throne in any way. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, no, I don't mean to tease you about your accomplishments, whatever. I'm just saying they're not sophisticated. She wasn't. So she would have been very honored for ceremonial reasons, but she was not politically savvy. In fact, remember, it was Nathan the prophet who came to her and said, "You need to wake up, girl, because they're getting ready to set his brother in down the street at the big barbecue, at the roast, and you're getting ready to find yourself with a sword in your throat." So she didn't see it coming there either. Okay. So she says to Solomon, she's come in to see Solomon. He's bowed before her as his mother. He's honoring her. And he's sat on his throne, and he's asked her to sit on a throne seat near her. And she said, "I want to make a small request of you. Please do not refuse me." And the king said, "Ask my mother, for I will not refuse." This is, you remember, Herod said, "If it be half my kingdom, I will give it to you." You know, these are hyperbolic, grandiose kind of course I will give it to you. And she said, "Well, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother's wife." And the king answered and said to his mother, and the tenor in the room, the temperature in the room switched, said, "Why are you asking for Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Why don't you ask him also for the kingdom? Why don't you just ask me if I should just give him the kingdom? For he is my older brother. Even for him, Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah. Why don't you ask me to give them the kingdom as well?" He said, "You know, this is a plot, and you're being used as a pawn." Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, "May God do so to me and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life." This is your typical Asiatic curse, self-curse for the purposes of, you know. "Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me on the throne of David my father, who has made me a house as he promised, surely Adonijah will be put to death today." So King Solomon sent Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him so that he died. Then to Abiathar the priest, the king said, so Abiathar, who's also involved in this plot, who is faithful to David, but aligned with Adonijah. So he brings him in. He says, "Go to Anathoth, to your own field, for you deserve to die. But I will not put you to death at this time, because you carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, because you were afflicted in everything with which my father was afflicted." Now, who besides Nancy and Bobby, you knows what Anathoth is and what it's about? Anybody? It's fun. This is fun. I know Nancy knows. Yeah. Anathoth is the town about 12 miles north of Jerusalem where the Levites live. It is the home of Jeremiah the prophet. You remember that, didn't you?
No.
Okay. It's the home of Jeremiah the prophet. It is an enclave it's a home for priests. It's a city where, remember, the Levitical priests lived in Levitical cities, and that's where it is. So he's telling Abiathar, go back to your hometown, where you're from. All these priests who, all the priests, it's the Roswell to Atlanta, where all the priests live. Okay, so he said, go back to your hometown there in Anathoth. Anathoth is most famous for being Jeremiah's home. Anyway, so go back there. You deserve to die, but you were faithful to my father. You carried the ark before him. You suffered with him at the hands of Absalom, etc. Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest to the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord, which he had spoken concerning the house of Eli and Shiloh. Remember that in Samuel's day, that the high priest was Eli, and his lineage was cursed because of what happened with the way his sons behaved. And Abiathar is the end of Eli's line. Zadok was appointed chief priest in Abiathar's place. Now the news came to Joab, for Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. He's run up to the tabernacle. He's seen this trick before, right? Adonijah did this. It was told King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord. Behold, he's beside the altar. And then Solomon said to Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, go fall upon him. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said, thus the king has said, come out. But he said, no, for I will die here. Adonijah brought the king the word, saying, thus spoke Joab, and thus he answered me. And the king said to him, do as he has spoken, and fall upon him and bury him, that you may remove from me and from my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. And the Lord returned his blood on his own head, because he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he, and killed them with a sword, while my father David did not know it. Abner the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood return on the head of Joab on the house of his descendants forever. But to David and his descendants and his house, his throne, may there be peace for the Lord forever. Benaiah the son of Jehoiada went up and fell upon him and put him to death. He was buried by his own house in the wilderness. The king appointed Benaiah the son of Jehoiada over the army in his place. And the king appointed Zadok in place of Abiathar. Now, when Joab did these things, he alienated twice the entire northern peoples, particularly with Amasa. With Abner, he totally alienated the house of Saul, but also, by extension, the northern tribes. When David's king, the people in the north are putting up with this, but Joab is infamous among them. And when Solomon executes Joab, he sends a signal to all these people in the north, I have eliminated this thing. I've given you your revenge today. And it seals them towards Solomon. It establishes his house. It's not why he did it, but that is the result of it. I don't know if you can think of some really awful politician from the past who was a no-goodnik. And now that regimes have all changed and he's still around and whatever, and then someone comes along and they bring him to trial and send him to jail, you go, they finally got the son of the gun. You know, they finally got him. Now the king sent and called for Shimei. Remember him? The rock thrower, cursor, spitter. Said to him, build for yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there. Do not go out there for any place. For what will happen on the day you go out and cross over the brook of Kidron. Remember we talked about that? You will know for certain that you shall surely die. Your blood shall be on your head. Now, are y'all familiar with the landscape here where the book of Kidron is? Remember we talked before about the Mount of Olives, and then we have the Kidron Valley, and then we have Mount Carmel, and then beyond that, Mount Zion. In order to get to Mount of Olives, like where the Gethsemane was, you had to go down Mount Carmel, cross the brook of Kidron, and up onto it. So remember when Judas went looking for Jesus the night they were going to arrest him, he knew that Jesus regularly took his men out of the city, through the Kidron, and up onto Mount of Olives for prayer and worship and conversation, whatever. In fact, it was from there that they looked at the temple one morning and he said, not one stone will be left upon another stone, and this will be the sign of my coming, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, all this. So the Kidron Valley is between them. Right now, it's full of highways. If you look down from the Mount of Olives into the Kidron Valley, you see two main four lanes going through that area. And above the Kidron Valley, you see the Eastern Gate, which is sealed off. It's concreted off. One of the things about the coming of the Lord is that he will, when he comes to the Mount of Olives, all of this topological stuff happens, but he will enter through the Eastern Gate, and that's been sealed off, awaiting for the coming of Messiah. All the way up the hillside from the Kidron Valley are the burial graves of the Jews. You see all these mausoleums and flat stones and whatever, and as you walk up that hill, there's Jew after Jew after Jew buried there, and people who want to show honor to them will come crawl up that hill, hot days, whatever. And they'll take a stone and they'll lay it on top of their stone marker. They got a big flat stone thing on top of their grave, and they'll lay stones on it. So you see stones piled up on top of these things. But it's you'll see some big stand-up mausoleums for people particularly rich, whatever. But you know, that was a burial ground because it was not considered holy. Because it's on the other side of the Kidron Valley. You can sort of see all of this here.
And what does the stone represent on
the? Someone, you go to see your father's grave.
So it's just to say I've been here.
Yeah, that's right. You put a stone on it. It's honor, whatever. It's just a way of honoring. Pardon? Yeah.
I just went to a Jewish funeral and saw stones on all the headstones.
That's it.
Wanted to look up why. So
if you brought flowers there, they wouldn't last 10 minutes.
Wow.
It's 110 degrees.
Yeah.
And it's in full sun. I mean, when you get to the Mount of Olives, what you get is the shade of olive trees. But below that is nothing but. Remember, this was at one point in time a very stark area. On one side of it's full of garbage; it's burning all the time, and it's not a pleasant place. Now it's got a highway running through it, and I'm sure they've cleaned out all the garbage pit and all that sort of stuff. So he's saying to him, "You go to Jerusalem and you build a house and you stay there. And if you ever cross the Kidron Valley, you're a dead man." Shimei said to the king, "You know what? That's fair. The word is good. As my lord, as king, has said, so will your servant do." So Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. It came about at the end of 3 years that two of the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, son of Maacah, the king of Gath. So he had a couple of servants who probably took a bag full of money or, who knows, horses, sheep, whatever. And they fled to the Philistia, to Maacah, the king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, "Behold, your servants are in Gath." Well, Shimei arose and saddled his donkey and went to Gath to Achish to look for servants. Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath, and he told Solomon that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had returned. So the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, "Did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly warn you? You will know for certain that on the day you depart and go anywhere, surely die. And you said to me, 'The word which I have heard is good.' Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord and the command which I laid on you?" The king also said to Shimei, "You know all evil which you acknowledge in your heart, which you did to my father David. Therefore the Lord shall return evil on your head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David will be established before the Lord forever." So the king commanded Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. He went out and fell upon him so that he died. The kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon. Solomon gave Shimei all the chances in the world. David gave Adonijah the chance to survive, or Solomon did. All kings have hitmen, all of them. He was the head of the king's bodyguard. So he said, "Go execute that guy."
He was very efficient.
Yeah, he was. Well, he was there for a reason. You know, it wasn't because his croquet skills were good or his knitting. You know, he was quite efficient, but which brings us to progressive revelation. We're going to stop here, but the way these people behave, with the ethics that they use, the morals they use, are sometimes appalling to us because they don't compare to our morals and ethics, and we're not very moral and ethical sometimes anyway. But the reason is because of two things: the Laetitia's superiority of God and progressive revelation. So I think what we'll do next time is, if that's all right with you all, is study progressive revelation, and then we'll go get Solomon and Abishag and drop in on their little party after we get back in the room here and everybody can participate. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so then we'll be a few weeks then before we get there. Comments? It'll be at least 2 weeks of progressive revelation, at least. Depends on how fast I move through it. I'll probably try to get it done in 2 weeks because it's actually bigger than that. But you know, I can count on y'all to read a bunch of it yourself. Basically, I think it's just good for people who are studying the history of these times to understand why it's appropriate and right, even though it doesn't seem appropriate and right to us. All righty. Well, I guess if there's no other comments, then somebody pray us out. Okay, I gotta say something. Okay. All right, you all know there's a scripture that says, where Jesus says, If you're afraid to confess me before men, then I'll be afraid to confess you before my Father who's in heaven. Okay? Yeah. I don't think we want to get to heaven and the Lord say, I never heard your voice praising me in public, ever. Yeah, I mean, I've heard those little things in your bedroom real quiet, but I've never had you stand up and praise me in public. You know, I'm stretching this, folks, you understand? But here's the point, huh? Here's the point. Don't be afraid to pray publicly because you don't think you do it very good. Because we all went to first grade before we went to second grade before we went to third grade or whatever. You will need at some point to be able to stand up and publicly confess your faith. So I encourage you to try to put aside your basic shyness or the fact that you don't think you do a very good job of it, and you know, learn how to publicly beseech the Lord, praise the Lord, and talk to the Lord. It's just a conversation between us and God, and no one gets a grade on it. It's just it'll be good for you. It'll be good for you to. So one of the things that happens, it's kind of like some people, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to do that because I look like a fool. Well, you won't look like a fool to God. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to be in a position where we care more about what the world around us thinks than what we want God thinks. I mean, God wants our abandonment. This is not like you're going to hell if you don't do this or whatever, but I want to encourage you to get outside of your comfort zone and praise God, talk to God, beseech God, just converse with God. You're going to need it. Mm-hmm. You're going to need it. It'll make you bold in appropriate ways. All right, enough said. God bless. And if you don't, I'll tease you unmercifully.